From the Sky News Centre, a group of children have been injured, two of them critically, after being hit by a car in Liverpool. It happened outside a school in the Toxteth area. Six 11 to 13-year-olds have been taken to hospital. The car's driver, who's thought to be in her 80s, was treated by paramedics at the scene. Rolf Harris has been charged with seven more counts of indecent assault. He's already serving a six-year jail sentence for sex offences. Matt Steele has more.
Police have been investigating claims made by seven women against the entertainer as part of Operation Yew Tree. They date back as far as 1971. The victims were aged between 12 and 27 at the time of the alleged incidents. Today, the Crown Prosecution Service has decided to authorise the charges, saying it believes they're in the public interest. The 85-year-old will appear before magistrates next month.
Prosecutors have accused footballer Adam Johnson of abusing his revered position in society when he had sexual contact with a 15-year-old fan. The 28-year-old denies two counts of sexual activity with a child. He's pleaded guilty to two other charges. Drug giant GlaxoSmithKline says it's considering an appeal after being fined £38 million for paying other companies not to make a rival antidepressant. Competition authorities say it meant the NHS paid over the odds for Seroxat. A celebration of the life of Jimmy Hill is taking place at Coventry Cathedral. The legendary former footballer, manager, administrator and broadcaster died in December at the age of 87. He was both manager and chairman at Coventry City. Football Association chairman Greg Dyke says Hill was a maverick.
It's special. He had a special talent. And he, you know, had that funny chin and all those sorts. You know, he was, I mean, you knew him. I mean, as a footballer, even as a footballer, you knew him because no one had a beard in those days and he had this strange beard.
And The Independent will no longer be published as a newspaper. The title will move online only from March. The sister paper, The Eye, has been sold off. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
Getting Bristol home with BCFM.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news as leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council and Knoll councillor, Gary Hopkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Tory MP Oliver Letwin's written a pamphlet way back in 1988 setting out plans to privatise the National Health Service. Despite his denials, those exact plans appear to be unfolding as we speak. Strikes at the NHS, but will they just end up being part of the destruction of the service they're trying to save? We speak to Neurology Registrar Bridget Ibbotoy, who's chair of the 7 Committee of the British Medical Association Regional Junior Doctors Committee. Also, we don't rob banks. Banks, we own them. The City of London as money laundering capital of the world. More evidence the real criminals have their hands firmly on the purse strings. And Sex, Lies and Julian Assange, the Western world's most powerful publisher under house arrest in London. The Committee of Swedish Doctors this week release their thoughts about Assange and what really happened over in Sweden. Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 Celsius, mainly cloudy, but some showers later on tonight. At the weekend, highs of 7-ish, a generally cloudy weekend with showers on Saturday, windy at times. Next week, highs down a little bit to 5, sunnier at the beginning of the week, patchy rain towards the end of the week and frosty nights. Next weekend, that's the 20th and 21st of February, highs of 10 Celsius, sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the Politics Show. Now, I bumped into you last week, didn't I, down at the Colston Hall. What were you up to there?
Well, we were making the point that The money that had been put into Green Capital, and we were particularly annoyed about this, having put in the winning bid ourselves and then Stephen Williams having got the money from government, we've not had proper disclosure of what the money's actually been spent on. And Bristol public are entitled to know what the £8 million of public money has been spent on.
Look, it's all been a success, and it's all happened, it's all gone. Why does nobody really cares about this, Gary?
Well, we don't know yet with regard to rating in terms of success. I mean, we've seen lots of parties and lots of people have had a fun time. The original purpose of the Green Capital was to improve the sustainability of the city, improve the right sort of investments and give us a long-term legacy and a better way of actually doing things.
But we've yet to see
whether that's actually happened.
But you take my point, no one really cares. We had a great time last year. Why does anyone really care where the money went?
Well, I think you'll actually find when you start asking around, a lot of people are asking, yes, we do want to know where that went. One of the purposes of the Green Capital was to involve lots of people who haven't normally been involved in sustainability projects around the city. But you ask people in large parts of the city, what's the Green Capital been about? And they've seen posters, they've seen advertising, but they really don't know what it's about, still.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what do you make of this? Is this a bit of a storm? We did talk about this last week, but a bit of a storm in the teacup. I mean, it doesn't look as if there's going to be any more disclosure, Gary, because you know we've had the merchant venture chair of Bristol 2015 Limited saying, well, actually, I've ticked all the boxes, I've dotted all the I's, crossed all the T's, and done everything I'm supposed to have done. All the audit committees that are supposed to have seen this have already seen it, Martin.
Well, as we said last week, the setting up of an independent company to carry through the project has created a layer of untransparency, let's put it that way. And I don't know enough about it to have a very strong opinion, but if there isn't not the normal kind of accountability, because you've got an opaque structure, you know, a third sector structure which isn't actually accountable, then I think there's certainly cause for concern.
I can remember this first kind of appearing on the horizon, Gary, back in, crikey, was it December 2014, when the Bristol Cable did the new newspaper did a very good report on where it looked like the money was going at that point. They're saying, and they still say on their website, £500,000, that's £500,000 out of 1.35 of the Green Capital grant money went to organisations with close links to the awarding body. And also the selection criteria have been kept secret from councillors and the public, so we're not allowed to know how they decided who to give the money to.
Unfortunately, that's true. That's not saying that any of the board members did a particularly bad job or whatever. It's a matter of saying that the public have a basic right to know. It's public money. We should know exactly where the money's spent. And then the public can actually judge. There's been lots of freedom of information requests gone in on this. And actually the money, the public money, sat with the council. They were told by government, you have to take responsibility for this money. It can't be privatised. But in actual fact, what happened was that they just paid all the invoices that were sent in by Bristol 2015. But freedom of information requests have been told, this organisation is not subject to freedom of information.
The Bristol Cable said that a third of the 1.35 million, that particular tranche of grant money, was distributed to organisations which Bristol 2015 board members own, manage or work for. Andrew Gerard, who we heard from last week, he's the chair of something called the Centre for he's a trustee of the Centre for Sustainable Energy, which receives nearly £100,000 from the Grants Fund. Alice Ferguson, the mayor's daughter, receives £41,000 for her charity Playing Out. And fellow board member Malcolm Shepherd also works as CEO of Sustrans, which will be awarded £132,000. It does seem like cronyism, Martin.
Well, I mean, ostensibly, possibly, yes. I mean, I think it's definitely something that needs to be investigated. I think this whole idea of actually not accounting for things and just paying, you know, creating another layer between the public money is, you know, that's definitely fishy, isn't it?
Well, I mean, one basic fact here is if money is going to people who are closely connected with the mayor and to people on the board which he's appointed, and we're not being given any kind of openness about how they were chosen. It does start to look like this was a conversation in the living room or down the pub, Gary.
Well, there are rules with regard to public money and what should be disclosed. That's part of what the Freedom of Information Act was about.
But what they'll say is, well, hang on, this is a private company. It's not public.
Well, that's what they're saying, and that's actually being challenged at the moment, because we're saying this is public money. This does look like a means of just hiding what's actually been going on. And bluntly, that's not acceptable. At the moment, we are actually speaking to central government to say, look, you know, guidelines seem to have been broken here. Are you going to back us up and do something about this?
And are they?
We don't know yet. Certainly there's a big fuss coming up, and the concern, the public concern about this is spreading and getting louder and louder. I mean, I saw a most amusing letter in the paper today from a chap who said, I'm one of the lunatics from Henley's. He said, I'm not a member of any party, but I want to know where my money's actually being spent.
Well, fair enough. Also, we were due to have Gus Hoyt in here today, but found out from him last night it was organised before Christmas, but that you couldn't make it, Gary. So thanks for stepping in at the last minute. But I did want to talk briefly about the what's been happening with the Malcolm X Centre and some of the other institutions in the city. I mean, we've had, since we last spoke to you, a bit of a debacle with the Carnival Committee being told we're withdrawing funding from you, and we've decided on another committee who we think can do the job better. We're going to be funding them instead. We've got the removal of trustees. I think it was actually happened voluntarily at Malcolm X Centre, and we've also got the dance centre at, which has been told that they won't have their lease renewed. So it seems that there's a lot of changes going on. The community groups around the city are finding work. The mayor is not happy with who's running things, and he's decided he wants his own people in there.
Well, if it's not the mayor or something directly under control, he's not happy with anything, I'm afraid. And that applies on a very wide basis, not just those organisations, you say, but lots of other things in the way that this city's actually running.
Give us some more examples, then.
Well, I mean, neighbourhood partnerships, as an example, which were set up to allow councillors and local people to work together to make decisions. Unfortunately, the way that the restructuring is now happening, they're not being allowed to make decisions. And there's a level of bureaucracy and centralised control, which the irony of it, of them supposed to be neighbourhood partnerships, just seems to be completely lost on the mayor. The spending that's happening is all massively centralised. Organisations that are actually community-based and real are actually being completely and utterly sidelined. I mean, I was speaking today to the some of the representatives of the parents of the Bush Respite Centre. The amount of money that's supposedly been saved, which I think is a complete illusion, actually, when you look at the detail of it, in terms of closing that down, is ridiculous, especially when you put it alongside the millions, and I mean millions, that are now being squeezed out of people for residence parking schemes. The mayor is pleading poverty on behalf of the council. I'm afraid it's just not true.
And what's happening with things like reserves? Because I understand quite a lot of money that the council generates. I mean, for a business person, a businessman, to come into local government and start running the city like a business, it's a cash cow, isn't it? There's all sorts of things that they can get money from that they don't have to lift a finger for.
Well, yeah, I mean, the parking schemes are one example. Charges for various things that the council actually does are going up. And we've got the budget debate on Tuesday, which will be an absolute farce, because last year we council people from different groups got together to pass amendments, which the mayor, I'm afraid, has completely and absolutely ignored.
But then that's what the mayor is there for, because the mayor is a kind of, for 4 years, a dictator.
Well, amusingly, when we went up to speak to Greg Clark a few weeks ago...
Who is Greg Clark?
He's the local government minister, the replacement for Eric Pickles. When we lobbied him in Parliament, said, look, we've got an amendment gone through the House of Lords to say, let us get rid of a mayor if Bristol wants it. And he said, oh, no. And then when we actually showed that people from all parties, including the Conservatives in the City Council, are saying this has been a disaster.
But the Conservatives, that surprises me when you say the Conservatives. I think of George as a kind of secret Conservative. He's so friendly with big business and the merchant venturers.
Well, I'm afraid that they don't like him either. it really is quite bizarre. But the Conservatives actually sent a letter up with us, because I went up to do the lobby with Greg Clark, which said, basically, we campaigned hard to get a mayor in Bristol, but I'm afraid it's gone wrong. We need changes.
Well, that's bound to be... People like you are bound to say that, Gary. You used to be running the city, the Lib Dems, and now George has taken over. And that's the public that backed him 4 years ago.
Well, I'm afraid the public that backed him 4 years ago are not likely to be backing him now. I wouldn't want to call who's going to win this election, because at the moment it doesn't seem like anybody is likely to be a clear favourite. And I think if the public had a choice of none of the above, get rid of a mayor, they'd romp home.
So are you saying that what's happened in St Paul's with the carnival, the Malcolm X Centre, is just symptomatic of a whole kind of attitude where George from the top is deciding from the top down, I want these people running this, these people, and I don't want communities deciding for themselves who's going to be running various community groups?
It's absolutely centralised. In a number of cases, he doesn't actually know what the detail of what's actually happening. But an officer will say to him, because, you know, we want to do this, we think this is necessary, and he'll just go along with it. If he doesn't know it, and he's absolutely, you know, opposed to discussions and working with councillors and local people, so I'm afraid they get completely ignored.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you saw Points West last night, but it's quite clear George has got quite an army of volunteers working on his re-election. So it's certainly, you know, it's certainly not a shoe-in for anyone, including George. But he's putting a lot of effort into this, and because of his, I suppose, PR, a lot of it during the last 4 years. He does stand a very good chance, doesn't he? He's got very positive press, particularly from the Post, Bristol Post, almost every week. Some little story saying something wonderful that George has done, a nice smiling picture of him in his red trousers. And, it does look as if that might actually win it for him.
I wouldn't want to call this election at all. I don't think there's going to be a popular winner. I think at the moment it's a matter of who's going to lose by the least. And I'm afraid that, yes, the PR was done to get him elected in the first place by the Post, and they're still at it. They are sort of trying, because the vast majority of their readers don't approve, they're trying to nuance their message a little bit to try and look a little bit balanced, but it's not working at all. And bluntly, you know, I think Bristolians have realised that the experiment of having a mayor has failed.
But it wasn't an experiment, in a way. It was a reaction against parties like yours, Gary.
No, it wasn't a reaction against ours. It was people being told nothing is actually happening in the city, nothing's being done, and then a whole list of things were trotted out that was nothing to do with the council, that the council was actually blamed for. And people in Bristol... They do like new things. They do like experiments. They do like to try things. So by the tiniest of margins, they voted to try having a mayor. But I'll tell you now that if you asked a large percentage of those same people who voted to have a mayor, they would vote very differently now.
Martin, what's your view on this experiment with the mayor, and how do you think things are going to go in May?
Well, I was always opposed to having a mayor, so I'm glad that we might get the chance to overturn the possibility of having one. I think it was snuck past people. The turnout was very, very limited. And, you know, this is the problem with giving all power to people on a low turnout. I think one of the only positive features of this election for the mayor is that there will be a transferable vote. You can vote for one party, and then if you don't get what you want, your second vote will go to whoever you know, your second choice, which is a step towards some kind of more proportional system, which means that you get a wider proportion of wider selection of people running,
so,
and people can then transfer.
So, Gary,
that's the only aspect of it which I'm positive about.
If there
about.
Is a referendum on whether we have a mayor or not, when's that likely to be?
Well, it'll be a few years down the line, unless, of course, because the government are trying desperately to bring in the metro mayor for the combined authority for the four of them. That might be a time when even this government realises that's going to be a surfeit of mayors. I mean, you know, the clash of egos could be quite staggering and certainly very damaging.
Tell us
already there's conflicts between the mayor in Bristol and the surrounding authorities, which are not good for the region at all.
So tell us about the Metro Mayor, because as I understand it, will cover a much wider area than just Bristol, but it will also be representing Bristol, somebody.
Well, it'll be the councils that used to be urban, Cuba, as we call it, which is the Bristol and the three surrounding authorities, which are North Somerset, Bath and North East Somerset, and South Gloucestershire.
So one mayor for all of those?
That's what the government are looking to impose, and what they're actually saying is, we will give you power over this, this and this, if you agree to have a metro mayor.
That's funny. I can remember John Savage at Business West talking about this years ago as his little dream. You know, we've got to have a mayor that covers a bigger region. Of course, that means that it won't just be Bristol they're representing. They're representing a lot of rural areas, more wealthy areas, more likely to be a Tory, actually.
Every chance that it would actually be a Tory, yes, and I think that's another reason why the present government are very much in favour of it.
Can I just clarify? Is it the case that we'd still have a mayor in Bristol, a George Ferguson or another, and another mayor on top of them, representing the wider region?
That's what they want, and when we actually spoke to Greg Clark, we said this is absolutely ridiculous, and I think even he was getting the idea that this would be very clunky indeed.
But he's taking his orders too, Gary, isn't he? I mean, I suppose the idea, the sense of it, is that would be banging heads together, banging mayors' heads together in Bath, in Gloucestershire, in Somerset and here in Bristol to actually get them to agree on a few things.
Well, I think, I mean, although I don't agree with it, you can see that there's some logic in having a person responsible for the wider area for the combined authority. I don't agree with it, but there is some logic in it. There was never any logic in having a mayor for Bristol just for the city council. It's utter lunacy. It's not worked. The vast majority of people in Bristol know that it hasn't actually worked. But, I mean, having the two of them together,
double trouble. Anyway, the green capital business. I mean, I don't know what you think about it. I don't want to be too sort of negative about things, but I do feel like it seems to have been quite a lot of greenwash there, really, without much. So we've got the Metro Bus thing, which is happening, which might make a little bit of a difference, which is going to cause massive amount of disruption. Very much a kind of halfway house to doing some sort of decent public transport system. Can you point to anything in the green capital year that you think is going to be a lasting positive legacy, Gary?
Well, actually, the Metro Bus, if you actually remember, this was the public transport system that the mayor, until halfway through his election campaign, was pledged to get rid of. And what he's actually done instead is delayed it and increased the cost. The stuff that we were actually doing before, which was the moving towards a circular economy on waste, that's one of the reasons why we won. And we were doing so well. In actual fact, promises that were made to the judges have actually on that been broken. We've gone backwards, I'm afraid.
Well, hang on a minute, because you guys, you Lib Dems, hired May Gurney, didn't you? And they just promptly went broke.
May Gurney won the competition, and actually, after they came in, they actually continued the improvement, and it worked extremely well.
Oh, hang on a minute. No, going broke is not... Well, they didn't. They ran out of money. They bid so low that they couldn't actually afford to carry on as a company.
Well, what we actually had was a position where the city council were paying £13 million a year for a £19 million service. I mean, if that's the worst that we actually get for 2 or 3 years, I'm not that worried. I don't mind the losses being carried by the private sector, and for once, the council getting the better of a private contractor, and that's what actually happened. And obviously, there was, shall we say, a mutual parting of the ways, and I can guarantee that the council didn't come out too badly on that, because of the way that the contract was actually written.
Okay, let's have a little whiz through some stories.
Other promises was the hydrogen economy that we were going to be moving forward on. I'm afraid the mayor dumped that straight away, and actually now we're looking at Swindon being one of the leaders on that, which is utterly bizarre, and believe it or not, EasyJet are doing more towards the hydrogen economy than Bristol City Council. It's one European green capital.
Sounds to me as if, under the mayor and under the green capital, a lot of the officers seem to be having a lot of power. I mean, you're saying to me that, well, they're turning to George Ferguson and said, we think this and that should be done. Is that the case, that George is just signing that kind of thing off?
In lots of cases, that's what's actually happening. The problem is that you've got the assistant mayors who have no power and no control. And the mayor's made it 100% clear he makes all the decisions.
Well, yeah, hang on. That goes for all the councillors too, surely?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And what are you taking your expenses and salary and going up and voting, for example, on the budget next week? What's the point of that?
Well, actually, the budget vote is quite frankly, a bit of a charade, because the mayor will do exactly what he wants.
And what would you like to see him do? You obviously have got some amendments that you want in.
Yes, and we've put in amendments.
Give us a couple of ideas of what you would like to see next week from George.
Right. Well, we firstly want to progress the recycling centre in South Bristol, an absolute priority that was promised. And actually, council voted that through last year, and that's been ignored, but we're going to have another go. The swimming pool was planned and part started not far around the corner from here in Speedwell. That needs to be actually delivered. There needs to be some extra money for the community transport. We also, by the way, in the budget, actually found £3 million that the council is collecting, which it's not disclosed, because the last 2 years, the council has to every year put in an estimate of how much council tax it will collect, depending upon the number of properties it says it will have and what rebates it's going to give. The last 2 years, we've said, you've massively underestimated that. You're out by between 3 and 5 million. Both years, we were practically proved right, and the administration got more money than they said they were going to get. This year, we're saying exactly the same thing, and the administration are refusing to allow an amendment to be put which says use that money.
So they've got this little £3 million slush fund. What are they going to do with it?
Well, we don't know what they're going to do with it.
Put it in their back pocket.
Well, basically, the mayor, after the election, after budget has gone through, can do exactly what he wants with every penny that he has, you know.
Fascinating. Okay, Gary, well, good luck with all that next week, fighting for our money.
I think councillors are there at the moment to protect their own wards from the mayor.
Well, maybe. Indy Future in doubt as Johnson Press lines up to sell the I newspaper. We're not quite sure. Any time there could be an announcement about this, or maybe
there was
no
earlier on today.
Was there? Please enlighten us. What's happening?
Basically, they're closing down the main independent paper. In its present form, they're flogging it off to regional newspaper, which, to my mind, just doesn't make any sense at all. And they're trying to go online.
It might well be a regional newspaper group, Johnson Press, I think, maybe wanting to get into the nationals market, because they're finding that regional newspapers aren't doing too well. But certainly this is a massive blow, because the independent, I mean, certainly my contact with individual journalists in London, is they seem to be one of the best in the country. Certainly Mark Leftley's reporting on what's been going on at Filton with the privatisation of defence procurement and the threat to jobs at Filton has been one of the probably the best, well, head and shoulders above everyone else in the country. And you're quite right. They've been announcing today the independent newspaper confirms an end to print production with 100 jobs at risk. This is in the Telegraph. The Independent's confirmed it's ending print production following the sale of its I newspaper. Paper, which launched in 1986, will print its last daily title on March the 26th. Last Independent Sunday will be on the 20th of March. Publishing group ESI Media said the move to a digital-only model will have no bearing on the publication of its sister title, The Evening Standard, which is mostly funded through advertising. And this is run by Yevgeny Lebedev, who I think is ex-Russian. I'm not sure if he's even his family is from the KGB or something, Martin. But anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts about the loss of this national newspaper?
Well, Lebedev was actually a security, Russian security services guy. Well, I mean, nobody seems to be able to make print journalism pay anymore.
Well, they are through the Evening Standard. I mean, they're giving the Evening Standard away, but they're making their money there through advertising.
Yeah, well, then nobody's been able to make it pay through people buying. I mean, the Guardian's got a massive online presence, and they're losing £70 million a year. The Telegraph loses money. The Times loses money. I mean, proper quality journalism is now being funded by people who are basically hobbyists like the Barclay brothers and who want to push their opinions down other people's throats. It's not actually viable. And I don't know whether online journalism actually makes up for that, because there's a lot of comment, but there's not a lot of news gathering.
Just clarify about whether the editor and the owner of the Independent was a KGB spy.
Wasn't KGB, it was FSB.
Actually, it was his father, Alexander Lebedev, who was, and... Yevgeny moved to London at the age of 8, so I don't think we can really, unless he was an 8-year-old spy, who knows. But Gary, I mean, for you, what does this mean? Because I know we're quite often, when you're on here, we're talking about how politicians feel, what they're doing is reflected well or otherwise by the media, maybe nationally and locally.
I think it's a pity to see the Independent going, but I'm not totally surprised. I like to see it's there, but I must admit I never bought it, or very rarely bought it. Print media is in difficulties.
Well, one of the things they've said is the website is going to survive anyway. Media groups lose appeal against a secret trial, saying on the media here, a secret trial of Errol Incidal. This is in The Guardian this Tuesday, one of those bizarre articles where they say we can't really tell you anything about this because it's been a secret trial, but there are a few tiny little tidbits we can tell you. And The Guardian article starts with a warning: this article omits information The Guardian and other news organisations are currently prohibited from publishing. And what this article is saying is the Court of Appeal has refused to lift reporting restrictions on the secret trial of a law student who was cleared of plotting a terrorist attack in London. However, Lord Chief Justice Lord Thomas invited Westminster's Intelligence and Security Committee to investigate the role that MI5 and MI6 played in imposing secrecy on the case. So there is an investigation into this, but it's not in the newspapers. It's by the Intelligence and Security Committee, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in principle, secret trials are not to be approved of. I mean, you don't have secret trials. That's the whole point of trials. We need to find out what's happening. One of the things that was uncovered in a trial at the Old Bailey not long ago, this guy was being put on trial for allegedly planning to go to Syria to join one of the armed groups in Syria, and his defence lawyers argued that he was actually going to join a group which was being supported and armed by the British Intelligence Services and Armed Forces, and the case was dropped. Now, if that case had been carried out in secret, we wouldn't have known that. But I think that's very significant.
Gary, the background to this is that MI5 and MI6 said, if you want to bring this guy to trial, we've got evidence, but we're not going to bring it to court unless you make it secret.
Yes, not to be encouraged, that style of doing things. I think the ones that we really got to be worried about are the ones we don't hear anything about at all, which I'm sure are happening.
Well, this is kind of one of those, because we're not really allowed to know hardly any of the details, apart from that he was accused of having a bomb manual and plotting a terrorist attack, and he was found to have this bomb manual but not to be plotting a terrorist attack. Media launched a second appeal during which Thomas disclosed in open court that MI5 and MI6 have been responsible for the demands for all-embracing secrecy. He said the agency's suggestion they might withhold evidence from the CPS if the trial was not heard in secret was impermissible. It cannot be for the security services to say, well, we may not cooperate, because that would suggest they are not subject to the rule of law, Martin.
Well, exactly. That is exactly the point. And we know exactly what's happening in the United States of America. The FBI have put now hundreds of people in prison, and they've all been entrapped. So they basically approach vulnerable people of the right kind. You know, they've got some Muslim background, mental health issues, drug and alcohol problems, and say, hey, would you like to blow something up? And when they go, oh, I don't know, yeah, maybe, then they give them some weaponry, and they say, right, these are the terrorists. Now, in actual fact, that's completely reprehensible, absolutely unacceptable. If there is a terrorist threat, then you've got to find the real terrorists, not set up a load of patsies. But of course, that is exactly what goes on in the United States of America. Virtually everybody who's been sent down has been set up by the FBI, and that's why we have courts. That's why Magna Carta did not die in vain, as Tony Hancock suggested many years ago.
We had a story last week, didn't we, actually, about the fact that many people in the Muslim community do not trust converts to Islam, like, for example, the terrorist convicted of plotting a terrorist attack, Muslim convert here in Bristol a few years ago.
Well, these people tend to be the ones who are picked up by the security services as vulnerable to being... I mean, in the Bristol case, the young lad was, he'd been to Clifton College, he'd been in trouble with drugs and the law, and he was a perfect target to be picked up. I mean, I think he probably was planning something out of the ordinary, and he was actually grassed up by local Muslims who knew what he was up to. But nevertheless, they actually go out and look for these people and set them up. That's the suspicion.
There is,
and that, of course, is a deliberate misuse of public resources.
I think one of the worrying things there is that the Muslim community did rally round in Bristol, and it did take very responsible action in that case. If they, though, find out that things have not been done properly, that innocent people are being picked on, I think that there's a serious danger of that not happening in future.
Yeah. This week we hear about Clark's Shoes down in Street announcing major job losses for their centre down there. One of Somerset's most famous companies announced mass redundancies, leaving 170 people down in Street without their jobs. This follows hot on the heels, doesn't it, Gary, of Shepton Mallet stopping doing cider. Are we going to have any industry left in the next couple of years, in a couple of years' time?
Well, they haven't actually been making shoes in Somerset for the last 10 years.
But what they're saying now is that even the staff that are pen pushing down there, they're going to go too.
Yeah, well, not all of them, but some of them
There's
will.
There's going to be two left, are there?
They're talking about getting rid of 170 out of 1,200 that are still there.
But it does seem
which is quite a sizable operation for when there's no actual manufacturing happening in the UK.
Amazing, really. I think, you know, that we're not actually making things. Everything seems to be sort of moving bits of paper around nowadays. Well, not even cider.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we do actually in the West Country do make some very useful things, and we have actually got high tech industries in this part of the world. You know, the aerospace industry.
What, making missiles? Missiles are we making? Sending them over to Yemen?
Yeah, well, we don't like everything that they make, but certainly the aircraft industry in Bristol region is extremely profitable, high tech, and actually supports a huge amount of other jobs.
Martin?
Well, I fear that this may be a sign of the times that we're living in general. The Baltic Dry Index, which measures the cost of basically hiring ships to move stuff from A to B, is at the lowest it's ever been. And there are various other signals, what the economists call leading indicators out there, which suggest that we're on the cusp of an extremely severe recession depression.
Anecdotally, I was down at in the Isle of Wight just before Christmas, and I've never seen so many oil tankers sitting there. I mean, there must have been about 7, 8, 9, 10 oil tankers all sitting off ready to go. I don't know if they'd been to Fawley, given them, because Fawley's a big refinery down there. They're actually discharging, they were waiting to go and get some more. But there does seem to be, Gary, something to what Martin's saying here, in that there's a, you know, general problems with the economy. What are your thoughts? And also, maybe Martin, after Gary, we can hear from your thoughts about some of the stock market jitters there's been this week.
Well, I think that one of the major problems is that some of the fundamentals were not really tackled a few years back in terms of debt and borrowing. And world economy has still not got to the bottom of that. You cannot permanently keep on borrowing more and more money unless there's some reality behind it. And that is one of the reasons why the stock market has got the jitters. They've suddenly realised that, hang on, you know, we were here a few years ago. Are we going to get a repeat? Now, I mean, there have been some structural improvements, but there's still a major, major threat. And I'm afraid that, you know, markets realise that sometimes panic is the logical thing to do.
Martin, we've had all sorts of jitters this week. We've also had one great piece of news, which is there's a really good feature film out called The Big Short, which is looking back to 2008 and explaining in rather humorous terms how these massive financial institutions, who are rather puffed up with their own self-importance, can get things so wrong.
Yeah, well, I think Gary's right, but there were fundamental things were not done, and that was true of the Labour government in this country. You know, they bailed the banks out, but they didn't reform them. The coalition government then just basically passed the ball. The same thing has happened in the US. Deutsche Bank in Germany, of course, should have been crashed by a Greek default, but the Greeks were kept in the euro and then made to pay 100% of what they supposedly owed, which kept Deutsche Bank on the road for now. But of course, they've got the biggest exposure to derivatives of any bank in the system, and it could be that they will be the Kreditanstalt collapse in 1933 in Germany, in Austria, lead to a full-on recession, depression. We're really on the cusp.
In a nutshell, what are these derivatives, and what makes it so dangerous for Deutsche Bank?
Well, derivatives are basically bets, and something like Deutsche Bank has got bets on all sorts of things, and their derivatives book is several times bigger than the US national debt. That's one bank. And there's no way that you can. I mean, the derivatives market should never have been allowed to exist. Bruxley Bourne, who was the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission in the US, when the derivatives first arrived on the scene, said, look, we shouldn't be allowed to do this, because basically it's opening the door to indiscriminate betting. What used to happen with insurance is you have to have an insurable interest. And people can't see what's wrong with me betting that your business fails. I can bet that my business might fail, which is called insurance. But of course, the insurance then has to be proper. Insurance companies have to have proper assets to back up what they're doing, and so on. Derivatives are insurance on the cheap. People think that they're insured against an event because they've bought a derivatives contract on it.
But well, of course, the irony of it is, they started off with the idea of hedging against risk. To yeah. actually, so if something goes wrong, we'll insure against it happening. And that's how derivatives effectively started. But they switched round the other way now. They're actually being used as a way of magnifying potential profit, because that magnifies potential loss as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that is, in fact, insurance, if you like. But insurance is a regulated industry.
Yeah.
The derivatives, that you can buy derivatives for much less than it would cost you to take out proper insurance against something. And of course, the other thing is, you can actually bet on anything. It's yes. not, it's not even betting against your own stuff and covering your own backside.
Okay.
You can bet on somebody else collapsing.
Okay. Closures of courts and tribunals in England and Wales announced this week. 86 courts and tribunals around the country are being closed. In our area, in the southwest, to Cheltenham, is the, closing in Cheltenham. In Chippenham, their magistrates' courts, civil courts, and family courts in Chippenham. In Gloucester, the magistrates' court there. In Yate, magistrates' court. In Stroud, their magistrates' court is also closing. This is the cuts, I guess, Gary. Your cuts, actually. Lib Dem cuts.
No, not,
coming
not my
on
cuts,
through.
No.
Yes, from the previous government, actually. It started this whole process. This is just the results of the consultation that's been going on for over a year.
The review of what needs to happen has been going on for some while. The decisions are being made now. And basically, the concern that I've actually got is that people who, you know, are accused of not paying their council tax, but they might well have paid it, and the local authorities just fouled up. All of a sudden now, they've got to travel a distance and take a day to try and prove themselves innocent, rather than just being able to go somewhere close by. Cost of travel for some people is going to be quite a difficulty, and the time it's actually going to take.
I suppose one of the reasons for this is also to do with the lots and lots of legal aid being cut, so maybe people haven't been bringing cases that would have otherwise, Martin, under legal aid, come under legal aid.
Well, yes, I mean, one has to wonder whether this is some kind of genuine rationalisation which has got some genuine, you know, rational purpose behind it, or whether it's just a slash and burn because they don't know what else to do. Probably the latter.
Prime Minister's questions this week. We heard from Jeremy Corbyn, Leader of the Opposition. He was having a pop at David Cameron about housing again.
Jeremy Corbyn! Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister ought to be aware that just one home has been built for every eight that have been sold under his government. People are increasingly finding it very difficult to find anywhere to live. The Chancellor's crude cuts in housing benefits for those in supported housing are putting at risk hundreds of thousands of elderly people, people with mental health conditions, war veterans and women fleeing domestic violence who need support. Can the Prime Minister tell the House what estimate housing providers have made in terms of the impact of this policy on supported housing?
First of all, we are going to increase housing supply in the social sector by an £8 billion housing budget during this Parliament that's going to build 400,000 affordable homes. Now, when it comes to our reforms of housing benefit, yes, we have cut housing benefit because it was completely out of control when we came to government. There were families in London who were getting £100,000 of housing benefit per family. Think how many people, think how many roses were going to work, working hard every day, just to provide that housing benefit for one family. Now, we supported housing schemes, and we'll look very carefully to make sure they can work well in the future, but I make no apology for the fact that in this Parliament we are cutting social rents. So if Roses, who are living in social houses, going out to work, will have lower rents under this government. Yeah.
Well, the effect of that policy, which sounds good on a headline, is that we were starting to build a few council houses in Bristol from the housing revenue account. That's now had to be cancelled. A number of housing associations, because of the right to buy and because their rents will be squeezed, who were expanding and looking to provide social housing, are now stopping. And quite bluntly, the only way that you're actually going to solve the housing crisis in this country and tackle a number of the problems, including the ballooning benefit bill, is to build more council houses.
Martin, before we hear from you, there was an interesting article, I think it was in the Mirror, this one, how David Cameron plans to destroy Britain's social housing in 7 easy steps. Step 1, change the definition of affordable housing to make it much more expensive so you can't afford it. Step 2, sell off what you can, that's the right to buy. Step 3, bulldoze the rest, that's the recently announced blitz on poverty. We're getting rid of old estates and not necessarily finding anywhere else for people to live who used to live there. Step 4, make it look like you're going to replace them, but actually, as we've just heard, changing the definition of affordable homes means that you won't be able to afford the houses that they're being replaced with. Step 5, let people sell off starter homes at huge profits. Step 6, force people out of council housing wherever possible. That's this thing called pay to stay they're thinking about, where if you start to earn sort of decent salary, where you're not having to claim benefits anymore, you have to move out. And step 7, sneak it all through while nobody's looking. That was the late night session in the House of Commons, which got this housing bill through into law.
Well, it's becoming, I mean, the housing policy has been a mess for years in this country. We had 13 years of Labour government and they did nothing to resolve it.
But it's not a mess. It's helping lots of people who are already homeowners. Their value of their properties is going up. It's not a mess. It's great for them.
Well, until the bubble bursts. I understand the hedge funds are now shorting the London property market as well. They might, considering that the Baltic Dry Index is an all-time low and the Chinese economy is crashing.
And the Japanese. Well, indeed. The Japanese stock market went down 5%.
I'm glad.
And the Chinese might have gone down more, only it's closed.
I mean, all of that then feeds through the derivatives market to crash the property market in Britain. So, in other words, this is all pie in the sky, really. I totally agree with Gary that we need to build more council houses. Let's hope at the other side of this debacle that we're going to have, that's exactly what will be on the agenda, including for sensible Tories. Because the only way to stop property bubbles is to have an alternative social rented sector run democratically through local authorities, I would suggest, rather than housing associations, which actually balances the property balances the housing market. And that's what we used to do for a generation. And then suddenly we stopped.
That's because people with lots of wealth and lots of houses have decided to take over the policy. There was a very good article, by the way, in The Guardian on Monday by Paul Mason from Channel 4 News about housing. The headline was, "If we want to solve the housing crisis, we must answer these three questions." And just to summarise, he says the first question is, how much space are people entitled to live in? The second question, what's the optimal balance between private, social and state-owned rented housing? And the owner-occupied sector? And third, what do we mean by affordable? It's quite important, isn't it? If you can't afford it, it isn't affordable. And he sort of summarises towards the end. He said, maybe we need to start with the principles that everyone has a right to a home, that every person has a right to a minimum amount of space in that home, and that those who claim the right to own houses nobody lives in. Is that you? If you're listening out there, have you got a house? Actually, probably most people who've got several homes don't listen to this show. They should pay a hefty disincentivising penalty. I mean, that to me is the key thing, Gary, is if people have got property that they're just using as money in the bank, as an investment, and there's nobody even in there, then they should lose it.
Well, I think certainly that the tax system ought to be used to stop people. Well, actually, what used to happen, people used to get a subsidy with empty homes. But basically, I don't see any problem at all people having a second home being charged a lot more in terms of local taxation.
Well, you've sort of fallen into my trap now, because I'm going to say, what about all this empty property the council's got? Maybe the council should have it taken off them.
The council don't have a vast amount of empty property. Certainly it's the case that I think that there could be a quicker turnaround when property is vacated to get somebody new in. But the biggest problem that the council actually have is that they're not allowed to use the money to build more council houses. And some of them are sold off, and the government is actually increasing that pressure as well. The only thing that I do agree with, but not in a way that is actually happening, is that people, if they're on a very large salary, I think there they could pay the full whack rather than having a subsidised council property. But they're proposing to bring it in at about 30,000 or something, which is clearly ludicrous.
Well, when you've got two people working in Ludden in London, that's just not, that's not a, you know, it's not a serious amount of money, is it?
No, it just doesn't add up at all. But I mean, if somebody's on 100,000 a year, you can understand why they should be paying the full rent.
Also, at Prime Minister's questions, disability tribunals came up too.
John Nicholson!
Mr. Speaker, sir, on Monday I attended the Work and Pensions Tribunal appeal hearing for my constituent, Mrs. Jackie Millen, a brave, inspiring woman who has dwarfism. Despite being unable to climb staircases except on all fours, she was awarded zero disability points by her assessor. Can I ask the Prime Minister whether he has, as a constituency MP, himself attended any tribunal hearings? And if so, whether he found the process fair, dignified and compassionate?
Well, I'm very happy to look into the specific case that he raises. As a constituency MP, of course I have people coming to my surgery with inquiries either about employment and support allowance or indeed about disability living allowance. And also I've got the experience, having had a disabled son, of filling out all the forms myself and looking forward to the new system, which I think with a proper medical check will work out better. So I have listened to these arguments, but we have to have a system of adjudication that is independent of politicians.
Well, sounds like a good idea on the surface of it. Gary, what do you reckon of that? And this whole idea that somebody that has to go around on all fours scores zero disability points.
Well, I mean, some of them you just couldn't make up, could you? You really couldn't. And I'm afraid that, you know, I've dealt with constituents who've had dealings over employment and support allowance and, you know, acted on their behalf. And some of the decisions they've been come to are absolutely ludicrous.
I mean, isn't there a sort of rather a nasty, sort of almost fascistic twist to this, that disabled people are being treated like this? I mean, it really, surely they should at least get what they're guaranteed by law. They shouldn't have that taken away from them and then have to fight through tribunals and courts just to get what the law is there to give them.
I think that the concept of there being a review to look at is absolutely right. You can't permanently give out benefit without any check, but the way that it's actually being handled is extremely poor, and it's been used to penalise people who shouldn't be penalised. But that doesn't mean to say that you should not check whether people really are genuinely disabled and need the assistance.
But I mean, it does seem that that's not happening. I mean, those checks are happening, and they're consistently being got wrong. And it looks as if what they're doing is they're just trying to see if those people can manage to get some sort of money from somewhere else, from another charity or whatever, rather than what their statutory entitlement. I go back to the word fascist. This is actually a punishing disabled people who've done absolutely nothing wrong at all.
I think it's basically
putting them through real serious trauma and yes. The threat of losing their homes, etc.
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, there's a number of things that are happening which have similar connotations. And I think that the problem is that you set people saying, right, well, you've got to do a review, and then they realise that they've got certain targets to hit. So it doesn't turn into a genuine review. I'm extremely concerned at the moment with the people who are desperate to try and preserve the services of respite care at the bus centre. And the way that is actually being reviewed their need for respite care is extremely concerning.
These are human beings. They're not nuts and bolts. They're not widgets. Final story tonight. We're going to go to a clip from Channel 4 News about election fraud, at least alleged election fraud, looks pretty clear, by the Conservative Party at four elections, in the general election last year and some by-elections the previous year. This is Michael Crick's report, a little summary of it.
Thanet South was probably the most fiercely fought of all constituencies at last year's general election, with UKIP leader Nigel Farage hoping at last to get his own seat at Westminster.
That's not too bad, is it? 27 votes.
The Tories were dead set on stopping him and threw money and paid staff at the seat.
McKinley, the Conservative Party
and their man, Craig McKinley, triumphed.
18,848.
But was all the Tory campaign expenditure included in the local spending return they legally had to submit after the result? A return which crept in just below the legal spending cap of £15,016. Last month, we found the Tories left out of that return these bills for more than £14,000 at the Royal Harbour Hotel in Ramsgate, in the constituency, where we found senior party figures from London stayed for many nights. If one were to add the two lots of hotel bills and a share of the newspaper ads to the Tories' official local return, they'd be 2.5 times over the legal limit. Last night, Channel 4 News revealed how we'd found tens of thousands of pounds for hotel bookings during the three by-elections for paid Tory staff, many of them senior figures. And none of those bills we found appeared in their local expense returns. Yet Electoral Commission guidelines suggest hotels for party workers should be included. And this morning, ministers leaving Cabinet seemed to have got the message.
I think we've spent everything according to the rules.
You really think that?
Yes.
What do you think of the Conservatives spending tens of thousands of pounds in by-elections and not declaring it?
Excuse me?
You should abide by the law, shouldn't you? I mean, you're meant to be the party of law and order, aren't you? Got nothing to say. It's not like you. Do you think the police ought to look at it? You've been told to say nothing about this.
I haven't been told anything.
Well, actually, as Michael Crick pointed out, they'd all been sent a text, and he'd been sent a copy of the text that they'd been sent as well. Martin, we've had lots about election fraud over the last few weeks here on this show. This just seems like another one where 2.5 times you've heard there, overspending, and yet nothing seems to be being done about this.
Well, I mean, the politics and money is an extremely difficult subject matter. The Tories are trying to destroy the Labour Party's funding at the moment with their proposals. And, of course, the other problem is that you got 4 million people voted for UKIP in the election and they got one MP. That's not acceptable in a modern democracy.
Gary, what do you make of this story?
Well, yes, the point about proportional representation, which, by the way, we're not getting in the mayoral elections. It's a perverted form of that. But basically, I think not just the Tory parties, but others have been driving a coach and horses through the rules for years. There needs to be proper control to prevent money buying elections. And quite frankly, they've twisted the rules here, the Tories. The only slight benefit is that in this case UKIP suffered.
Thanks to our guest, leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, that's Gary Hopkins. After the news, Tory MP Oliver Letwin wrote a pamphlet way back in 1988 setting out plans to privatise the NHS despite his denials. Those exact plans are unfolding in front of our eyes.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning